You're listening to the Paul Cardall Podcast. Paul's guests are thought-provoking people, blessed with incredible gifts. These are those he admires and wants to share with you.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to my podcast. I'm Paul Cardall. We're talking with Aaron Espy today. He's a singer-songwriter from Minnesota. I've been listening to his music for over a decade. He's got a lot of solo albums. And his latest, man, this is a good one. His latest is called Up North. And the thing that I really admire about him is his priorities. We're going to talk about that, his commitment to family. And he's really built a business around his values and his life rather than letting the business manage his life.
Home, where my heart is. Home. Where my love lives, home, my beginning and end, home.
Hey, bud.
It's been a while.
I know. The first thing I like to figure out on these things is, how do I hide my face?
No. Shoot. You got a nice, thanks, comfortable space. You've got three guitars back there. Well, actually, you got four.
Oh, man. It's Guitar City around here. They're all either, so many have been given to me and so many have been lent, or I have like one nice guitar. I don't know about you. I can't imagine owning pianos like you own piano. You could probably only have like one nice piano. I have one workhorse guitar. The rest are like garage sale, mainly texture guitars, I call them.
Well, I like it because you can just pick up a guitar. I can't just pick up a piano. It's like drummers think they have it bad. Lifting all their gear. I can't even lift gear. I have to hire Polynesians.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a, my dad used to help out, in the town I grew up in. There's this concert series called the Northern Lights Concert Series. And my dad was a volunteer. And so he would get, like every, I don't know if it was like once a quarter, he would get the rider information from the band or whoever was coming. But I always went with him when we had to haul the piano, the Steinway, from the choir room, which was on the other side of the school, to the little theater in our town. And then, anyway, I'm keenly aware of how annoying transporting a piano can be.
Most artists today are just using the keyboards. You go to any show, you know, it's embedded into what people think is a real piano.
Yeah.
One of the magic tricks.
Yeah, exactly. What's your opinion on plugins and do you have, like, when you have to use a plugin, you have a go-to?
It's difficult because I'm a purist. Majority of my albums are all would be considered acoustic because it's real instruments, strings, piano. But the one that actually got like a dub award for is all keyboard. And because it's also the one where I first hired a producer. And he wanted everything. He's not like Rick Rubin where you just tell shit it.
Yeah.
Love yourself and you write better music, but mm-hmm. it was so specific to syncopating, so everything was in the pocket, because I'm such a, I don't know if it comes from a history of having irregular heartbeat, but I just a lot of expression and what we call retards in music, syncopation, mm-hmm. it's just more expression. So, but as far as my go-to plug-in, I use Ivory. And they have Bösendorf, Yamahas, and a Steinway. And again, it still sounds like a keyboard. To most people, it sounds real.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's still, I feel like I'm cheating.
Yeah. It's hard sometimes to justify, and I suppose it depends. In this town, for a while, speed was everything. I'm kind of slowing down now, and I'm in a different season, but so much of writing was like getting 100 songs a year and 100 master quality demos, and so you were just trying to work as fast as possible. And so I remember before moving here, a friend of mine, Busby, who passed away in 2019, but he and I went way back to MySpace days, but he was my connection to this town, one of them. And he had been here for a few years. And he asked me how many songs I was writing, because I was getting tired of touring, selling CDs out of my trunk, and just sort of hating music. And I just didn't know how to do music anymore. I started tuning pianos. I don't know if I ever told you that. I started tuning pianos for a while. I was like, that might be the only way I stay in the music business, is tuning pianos. So I apprenticed and did that. And then Busby talked to me about coming out here, and I was like, that, you know, he's like, there's no guarantees or anything, and you're gonna have to work really hard, but you know, it was the first I heard like there's a niche here where you can write, you don't have to perform, because performing for me was kind of killing me. I realized late in the game that I didn't like performing. I just had been doing it so long, and I thought that that's what you had to do. So Nashville and the whole idea of writing songs for a living was really appealing. But he started giving me assignments. I was living in Denver, and he was like, let's start with just one song a week. And I thought that was a lot at the time. And then when I moved here, it was, you know, that was drop in the bucket. It's just, but you're right. There's such a, it becomes a numbers game, and you have to get comfortable with writing songs to write more songs. And it's a great teacher in, you know, the saying, kill your darlings, where, you know, you can't be too precious with your art. There's a huge distinction between artists and songwriters, and I find myself caught between the two quite a bit, because I am an artist, but I also write songs and for other people, and try to craft songs that would be good for anybody to sing. But there is sort of a death to the artist self. You have to let go of some things, because the goal is different, I find. And maybe you've found this too with piano, but like, you know, Nashville, let's be honest, we're all here trying to make a living from our work. So part of that is figuring out what's commercially viable, and where's the overlap between commercial viability and what I'm good at and can authentically create. And that's an ongoing challenge.
And when I lived in Utah, Aaron, and I think kind of like when you're in Minnesota and starting out, I thought like Nashville was like, everybody knew what was going on. Everybody had it down, and you kind of are just left to your own surroundings to try to pull off a music career. And then when I came to Nashville, I realized like, there's so many distractions here, but at the same time, it's so great because you get to be around people who you can learn from, who are great songwriters, but you have to get into rooms with all kinds of writers, and you have to write, you have to write. And Tony Martin, who is a veteran at writing, he wrote Just to See Her Smile and a lot for Jason Aldean, and has, I don't know, I think he's got like 25 number one country hits. He said that, you know, when these young writers come in, they think they have, you know, they could just get a song to an artist and that it's going to be on the radio and everything's going to be wonderful. And it's surprising how these artists learn that you have to write hundreds of songs a year, which is like bleeding. You know,
all this gets very complicated easily. You just don't know what song is going to land. You have some, I don't know how it is with you, when you're writing it, you have a feeling. I've heard some songwriters say, yeah, like they know when they're writing a great song. I don't know if it's just because I'm more of an emotionally based writer or not, but I always find like these songs that I'm really invested in don't land as well. It's just like they meant a lot to me, but they didn't translate so well to anybody else. You have to use the craft angle to get what you want to communicate into the general listener's ear. It's not just going to happen because you feel really good about what you're writing. And if you're like me, I have no objectivity over my songs, because when I'm listening to them, I'm remembering how I play them, how I wrote them, how I, you know, when an element comes in, when it leaves, there's just too much distraction to listen to my own music. So I have no, my point, I guess, is when Making All Things New, the song that has done the best for me, I didn't know that was just another day for me in a writing room with my friend Doug.
Look at all the colors, wild, wonderful and true. Your breath light as a feather, like little whispers in the room.
But that's sort of the model here. It's just like you kind of punch in and you do the work, and then you hope for the best.
Yeah, I'm very similar, where I invest a lot of time and money into a particular project that I think is going to really expand my ability as a writer, and that people will really respond to it. You know, The Broken Miracle, I had Grammy winning artist on that record, and you know, full orchestra, all these incredible artists that are big selling artists, and that necessarily wasn't the intent. I was trying to communicate diversity, and everyone has a seat at the table. And then I follow up with a solo piano record, which most people know me for, and that's, that album alone has quadrupled the streaming of the Nashville produced commercialized album with all these artists on, and even the artists promoted it.
And have you found that's based on the algorithms versus whatever promotion you've put into it and they put into it?
I think at this stage in our careers, we're competing with our own catalogs.
Yeah.
Because when you have 100,000 songs uploaded to Spotify every week and 40,000 uploaded to Apple every week, yeah, I think the algorithm knows your style. The fans that listen know your style. I was thinking that, you know, I was thinking because of these artists that are on it, that it would figure out into their algorithm as well. But my wife, you know, and your wife, Heidi, who helps you, my wife basically said, look, bottom line, people just want to hear you play the piano.
Yeah. And I'm like, she just summed up, she just tells me what I'm supposed to hear, but it's like 5 years later where you're like, I think I'm just supposed to play the piano. And she's like, remember me telling you that?
So. I've been, that's so amazing. I don't like it. I don't enjoy, this is just me. I don't enjoy watching people play their songs on YouTube or, you know, I that's just not my thing, to watch somebody play their guitar and sing. And so I have never really embraced video and playing my own songs. And it's completely because of that. I'm just, you know, I'm being very egotistical in the sense that I think everybody's thinking what I'm thinking. But then my wife Heidi the other day was like, don't you think you should like perform more for your, because I'm uploading like these little short stories, I'm uploading things kind of seemingly to most people unrelated to music, but to me it's all, I'm just creating stuff and I think it's fun. But back to your point, she's like, maybe you should, you know, just sing some of your songs in front of the camera. And of course, she's, essentially people just want to hear you sing your songs. You know, for you, they want to hear you play piano. They, not that they aren't interested in other things you're interested in. Like if you want to make a collaboration record, it's not like they're going to throw stones or something, but in general they're like, we can't wait till Paul plays us some piano again.
Well, it's like, you know, Sting's going off and doing all this Gaelic guitar music about ships.
Who is doing this?
Sting. Like he'll,
oh, I didn't know.
Sting diverts and does these Gaelic classical guitar, Irish type songs about sail ships from the 17th century. His father was obsessed with this stuff, so he's working things out, I think, with his dad and doing this stuff. But bottom line is everybody wants to hear Roxanne.
Yeah.
Does he want to sing Roxanne? You know, and he's probably sold the catalog, so he doesn't even get residual off that. So it has to be a labor of love, but you know, I'm a fan. I would love to see and watch that stuff. But I think when we're on the other side, it can be stressful and we're always cautious and worried. And tell me if this is how you're feeling. Worried that it's just not going to be the record. It's just not going to cut through and it's going to just suck. You know, what is,
yeah, there's a lot of that. And you sort of, you know, and there's all kinds of great books that deal with this. I don't know if you read Stephen Pressfield's The War of Art. There's some other good ones, but just talking about the inner critic and getting over a lot of the internal stuff just to make the art. And after doing it enough times, you would think that it gets better, but it doesn't, you know, it doesn't really, for me at least, I just expect it now. I think that's the only difference. It's like, oh, it's going to come and I know what it looks like. And I know from past experience that I can get over this, but I just got to keep going. And that would be the only difference from me as a 20-year-old writing songs to me as I'm 41 now writing songs. It's just like familiarity with your demons and, and knowing that's, you know, not that you shouldn't go to therapy, because I've been and deal with some stuff, but in general, I've found when writing, they come back, and that's just part of the struggle. And I suppose if you just felt completely awesome the entire time you were writing, everybody would do it, and I'm guessing the songs would all suck anyway. So
yeah, I don't know anyone who is completely satisfied with the songs. They just turn them in, and they turn out in a demo, and then somebody picks them up. But it's I don't want to say it's luck, but it's in some aspects it's about writing enough songs and getting better. But yeah, right. As we get older, we either get bored of things we used to do and we evolve. We have to evolve. Or we just, you know, plow ahead and keep writing. And I want to talk about your new album, Up North. And one of the things that your music does for me and a lot of your listeners is there's a sense of nostalgia, a sense mm-hmm. of returning back to this time of innocence where we're discovering that life is a little bit more complicated than just being kids and playing with cars in the dirt. And there's a real innocence in what you do. You know, it's Taylor Swift seems to have a good taste in music because she's a fan. She discovered your music and put you on a playlist. And, you know, I've been listening, I think, for over a decade, but this new album, Up North, every song, man, is so interesting. What is the first song that comes to your mind? How do you feel about that record? And what's the first song that comes to your mind?
Well, thanks for all that. The first song that comes to mind with it is probably the least popular, and you know, if any, I let's just off the bat say none of them are popular. But other than that,
it's just getting started.
The song that started it for me is Sheltering Oaks, and Sheltering Oaks was the name of a nursing home that no longer exists that my grandparents were in. So a big part of my childhood was my grandparents, because they lived two blocks away from me.
Well, Grandma broke her hip, that was the start of it. The family began to talk. Even if we share all the work to take care of her, it's too much, so we made the call.
Sheltering Oaks. It was back in the days when you could just ride bike and go see your grandparents and hang out. But so there's half of my childhood where they were two blocks away, and then half where they were both in the nursing home. And for whatever reason, this started during the pandemic, I just started following my curiosity, which whenever I get curious about something, I see it as kind of a check engine light, and I pay attention a little bit more. So even though I knew my publisher wasn't probably interested in me writing a song about a nursing home, I just decided to go with it. But that's the song I think about when I think about the album, is Sheltering Oaks. There's a balance between, you know, wink and nudge and hey, I'm actually sharing a piece of my heart here. Don't stomp on it.
Yeah, it's very, there's a humility to your writing. It's very honest and you know, when I was listening to Sheltering Oaks, my grandmother, who lived to be 100, the last couple of years of her life, went into a care center, and during COVID, weren't allowed to visit her. And she's got like 72 great grandchildren. And everybody wants to visit her, and it wears her out. So we're trying to see her through the window, you know, and she had to wear a mask in her own room. And then my wife, Tina, her dad was in a a care center. So that song, for a fan, connected in such a powerful way. Is there another one that what's one that's really resonating right now with people, with your fans?
I get a lot of feedback on Liver and Onions.
Liver and Onions on Tuesdays, me and Grandpa at Nelson's Cafe. Yuck ish the look of that dish, but I like going there anyway.
That was the start of a children's record. Now it was just thinking about, this was in 2018 maybe.
Yeah.
And I just thought, if there's ever a time I should be writing a children's album, it should be when I have four boys under the age of 9 or 8 or whatever it was then. So I was just thinking about these experiences I had as a kid. But it came out, and I say this, I have a hard time doing, I tell people, like, if I sing Happy Birthday, it sounds sad. It sounds like a very sad song.
Mine's very spiritual. People come to Jesus on my Happy Birthday.
People are raising their hands.
Yes.
So it's not a, it when I'm trying to write a funny song, it's difficult for me to present it, because it's just the vessel God gave me is more, it's not primed for that. I have this thing I do with my newsletter, and I'll send them like secret songs. And so I sent some people that song. This was a while back. And one listener said that he's like, actually, this sounds like just a regular, you know, a song that could be on one of your regular albums. And I at the time had just seen it as a kid song, but people have said that it's three people. For your listeners, it's a song about a kid doing things he hates in order to be closer to the people he admires and loves, you know. And for me, it was going with my grandfather to Nelson's Cafe on Tuesdays. They would have Liver and Onions, and I if you've ever looked at Liver and Onions on a plate, it looks like you can Google it, but it doesn't look appetizing at all. And so for me, just kind of being around it was gross, but I also wanted to be near my grandpa. So, and if he asked me to join him, then of course I'm going to go with him. And another one was getting haircuts from my Uncle Duane. He was the barber. And it's not like I necessarily wanted to get haircuts. But I enjoyed being around him, and I knew that, like, if I went and got a haircut at a certain time in the day, I knew that he would probably take a lunch break, and he'd always, you know, ask me if I'd eaten lunch and wanted to go with him. So I would plan my haircuts around the lunchtime hour so I could spend a little extra time with him. But, you know, these are things a kid's doing and not saying. It's just, and you see kids even today have their own way of doing it. But I was just trying to bring all that out in a song. And then, of course, the last one being, these are all three. I honestly should do a follow-up with the women in my life who have formed me. This one was all, my grandpa, my uncle, and my dad. So the last verse is about my dad and us setting up chairs. It's not like I wanted to go to church and set up folding chairs with him, but, you know, I liked being around him. And I think for whatever reason, even though those are specific memories, people replace them with their own version and they can see themselves in the song. And that's, you know, that's for a songwriter, that's the top of the mountain for me, to get feedback. And that's the goal, really.
Yeah, there's so much. And I imagine having four boys today versus the time that you and I grew up, where, you know, only a couple TV channels, and you're younger, so you're more of a transformer, the Transformers era.
yeah,
Nick Jr. And I'm like GoBots, you know.
what did you just say?
The GoBots were before the Transformers.
Amazing.
They appear to be mighty robots, but you change them into mighty vehicles. GoBots and Super GoBots, each sold separately.
GoBots, 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 mighty robots, mighty vehicles, GoBots.
GoBots and Super GoBots, Destroyer, Sightkill, and Leader One, each sold separately from Tonka.
They were a Japanese company, and then the Transformers came around, and no one ever heard of the GoBots again. But they were better. it's like the Atari versus the Intellivision.
Nintendo. Yeah.
Well, Nintendo's your age. Mine was Atari 2600. Yeah. So,
right.
We were lucky if we got any graphics. You know, 8-bit. Yeah, you should write a song called 8-bit Games.
There's a movie called 8-Bit Christmas, which if you haven't watched, you should.
It's awesome.
So good. Yeah.
Your boys love that movie?
They love it. They love it. And they love that I love it, because it's all about video games. And anytime I show any interest in video games, they appreciate it, because I think they feel my sensitivity towards wanting them not to play video games as much as they do. And that's a lot of that's parenting stuff. A lot of that's my own work I need to do. But yeah, 8-bit Christmas was fun for all of us. I'd strongly recommend it to any of your listeners.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You seem to, and I remember when I was over there, you had, and I would have loved to grown up in that house, because you had little dirt bike trails in the backyard, and most parents don't think today that you just send the kids out to ride their dirt bikes, and it's very 80s 90s. And are you just, where does that come from in trying to create for your sons this mystical world?
Well, I you know, I'm in competition with iPads and Roblox and all that stuff now, which is hard. And I'm trying to find the balance between outside inside stuff. I'm reading a great book right now that I recommend. It's called Inside Kids in an Outdoor World, or no, Outdoor Kids in an Inside World. That's what it's called. And just trying to come up with ways to connect them to nature more. I think a lot of it is from my background and growing up in a small town. We had on the weekends, it was really, you just go to the woods. We had a little cabin with a wood burning stove and a fireplace and no electricity, and just trying to, there's something inherently good when you build a fire, when you play in the dirt, we try to each summer grow a garden, because that's one of the easiest ways to just naturally get them into the dirt. There's so many things they can help with, or, you know, experience eating a carrot out of the ground or whatever. But yeah, I think it comes from my own parents, my dad especially, his love of nature. Even if we called him right now, he's probably like snow blowing the cabin driveway, or, you know, he likes to drag trees and brush that have fallen and just build a big burn pile.
Sounds like my dad.
That's kind of what he, yeah, he's just, yeah, a simple guy, likes being around nature. He taught me to, you know, to hunt, and that's a big part of, I don't hunt anymore, but whitetail deer hunting where I'm from is very, very common. So I think living in the city, it's, and honestly, these days I feel like I'm failing at it. But just trying to get them out more, go to Shelby Park. once you just get them outside, there's almost like a visible change. They're like, oh wow, fresh air, the world. See, that's half the battle, is just like getting them out there and then finding things to do, you know?
Yeah.
If they show any, I don't know if this is true for you and your daughters, but like any interest they show in something not in any analog activity, if it's baseball, if it's dirt bikes, if it's, it can be anything. Yeah. I kind of go over, like I like probably get overly excited and then turn them off, but we can find money in the budget for baseballs and baseball gloves. We can find money in the budget for I don't know, what are you into? Pole vaulting? Yeah, let's go get a whatever it is.
Yeah. We really have no control over our children and their personalities. We can say things are genetic, but in reality, who are these people? And we get to know them, and they're trying to get to know us, and we want to sometimes vicariously live through them. My daughters are so, just like your son, so different in personalities. My oldest just wants to play records in her room, play her guitar. She just released her own solo song, singer-songwriter stuff. Wow. And she listens to Queen on a record, or Pink Floyd. And she tells me things I don't even know about Freddie Mercury. I took her to London. All she wanted to do was go see where Freddie lived. And we get there. She was born like, you know, almost 15 years after his death. And she starts crying. Mm-hmm. That's the impact his music has on her today. Versus my youngest, who can tell you, and she's 10, she can tell you every constellation. She likes outside. Mm-hmm. And even inside, she is growing plants and knows the names. And she still has kind of that, you know how they still have that voice of a child, but then it starts to mature and you're kind of like really sad about it.
We're not quite there yet, but I can, yeah.
Yeah, when they start to actually pronunciate, it's sad.
Yeah.
You want them to, but it's sad because she's saying photosynthesis and all these technical terms I'm not familiar with.
It's the end of an era. Yeah.
I think that is the hardest thing in life, is your kids growing up, because they're never again going to be that age.
I'm trying. You sparked a memory of last night, my youngest son Magnus, who's 2.5, but he always, anytime I'm going outside, he wants to come with. But I was just taking out the garbage, and I heard behind me soon his footsteps. He came out, and I just put the garbage in there, and there was nothing special. There was nothing like out of the ordinary. It was just like a moment where you're like, this is not always going to be like this, where I'm watching him, you know, he's in front of me as we're going back, and he's just kind of doing his little steps, and it is like a reminder to just, I don't know, maybe that's it, just to take a moment and appreciate it, because it's so much of my life feels like, okay, what's the next thing? How are we making money this this month? Like, what are we? And a very, very future focused, and kids are like you're saying, you know, that they're going through these phases that don't last forever. So, you know, and trying to enjoy them while I can.
Yeah. And your music embodies kind of this overall conversation. There's an innocence and purity in life, and this is, I mean, what you're talking about is the motivation for men to be good fathers and good husbands and Well, I want to talk about your wife, Heidi. She seems to kind of help run the show for you. And
yeah, I could, if we can talk about her, we can talk all day. You need a champion, and she was the first to, you know, to be like, I believe in you. And yeah, let's, if she wasn't on board to move to Nashville, like, could you imagine, being at odds with your, or if your wife didn't really believe in what you're doing, that'd be so, so hard. You know, she's the first to, as we as artists go through our ebbs and flows of, yeah, I'm awesome. No, I suck. Oh, I'm pretty good. No, I'm not anymore. She's pretty solid about like putting things in perspective. She's also starting to like do more of the like, so I've only had one or two managers, and then she's just good at, we just at one point we're like, you should just manage me, you should be the person to keep the ducks in a row. And so she's my manager. She, you know, yesterday was packaging up vinyl that's going out. She does kind of all the things behind the scenes and keep stuff going. Plus she's, you know, she bears the brunt of the kids. We try to, the division of labor is, I feel like it's lopsided, but I try to do you know, as much as I can with pickups and drop-offs and taekwondo practices and, you know, all of the things. But she's amazing. Had it not been for her, I probably would have kept just like losing everything in the shuffle and not finally like talking to you now. So you need people in your life. Artists, songwriters, creative people need, the power of one goes only so far. And she's a case in point.
Like I always say, surround yourself with people who are much more intelligent and gifted than yourself, and then you come off looking pretty good.
Yeah. True. So, good advice.
Well, man, it's really good to talk to you. For listeners, I'm part of his mailing list, and I got to tell you, you're giving songs out. There's nice explanation of things that are going on. There's a real behind the scenes look into what you're doing. And I just want to read this quote from American Songwriter, and they were responsible for me starting this podcast.
Oh, cool.
But this is what they said about your music: is a refreshing glimpse into what is real and what is manufactured, played out in a song as inviting as it is wholesome. And I love that. And I love this new album. The one song I really like is Deer Hunting, because I used to go hunting. Now, white-tailed deer, I have to tell you, those are like little dogs compared to the mule deer. We would ask if you just shot a German Shepherd, but yeah, I hunted for years, mainly because, like you, I just wanted to be around grandpa, the uncles, and then you have to shoot this animal. You feel like crap. And I remember the last one, and everyone's gonna hate me for this, but I hit it. I'm a murderer. I go over it, and it was staring me in the eyes. Like, why? You know, and so you describe your song on your website. And if you're on his website, Aaron with two A's, everybody, AaronSB.com, it says, in the middle of nowhere, high up in a tree, a young hunter reflects on the strangeness of deer hunting and whether his father will ever return to collect him. Because they're like, I have so much memories of that, because I had a heart condition. They're like, okay, you need to stay on the lower road. We're going to go up high. we're going to go up high, and usually they're the ones that get everything, and you just stay down low. We'll push everything down to you. I would sit on this like arch that looked, we called it the jug handle, and I would just sit there for hours, bored out of my mind. And the only thing that would come down are does. We never hurt any females.
Yeah. And you'd have no, as a kid, you have no real, I mean, it's watching paint dry, and you're like 13 or 12 or 13, and you have to do that for a long time. It's a lot to ask, but I understand it. And some kids like take to it like a duck to water. But I always felt like I was half in it, half faking. Really, as you said, for the company to be, you know, to feel like you belong, and you know, the best times were in the cabin, you know, making pancakes and sharing stories about the one that got away or whatever.
Yeah.
But that's good. I'm glad you mentioned deer hunting, because it's gotten mentioned a few times, but it is like, it is one of the ones that I seem to get less comments about. So I appreciate that.
It's early November. I follow my father. Our footsteps crunch in the snow. Somewhere in the middle of Beltrami Forest, my toes have already froze. We stop at a tree, a tall creaky pine, with 2x4s nailed to the limbs. I climb up and sit down and wave to my father.
Well, thank you. Tell your wife thank you for organizing.
Oh, man. Thank you for having me on. It's great to chat with you.
All right. Let's talk soon.
Okay, buddy. Bye.
My big mouth, what was I thinking? 4 a.m., who was I kidding? My parents were right, but I can't pout. I begged and begged for this paper route.
Please show your support by subscribing to the Paul Cardall Podcast.
My first stop is Mrs. McCarthy. She won't tip if I am tardy. I pedal my bike as fast as I can. It's darker outside than a frying pan.
Paul greatly appreciates your feedback. Please subscribe to the Paul Cardall Podcast wherever you listen.